Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Welcome to another edition of Reconstruction, the podcast, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. You join me, David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and my colleague, Phil Bishop, news editor of the Construction Index website. Today is Wednesday, the 19th of February, 2020, and we're going to talk about three specific topics today. The first one is perhaps slightly off the wall, and we're talking about cannabis, aren't we, Phil? Sorry, Phil, I forgot to introduce you.
Morning, David. Good to be here.
So the first topic for discussion today is a slightly unusual one. We're talking about cannabis, and cannabis, of course, most people associate with the illicit drugs trade. But that's not what we're going to talk about today, because we're talking about the good side of cannabis, and that is cannabis as a material. As a resource. Perhaps we should talk use a different term to describe it. We're not talking about cannabis the drug, we're talking about the hemp plant. Its Latin name is Cannabis sativa, but we know it as hemp, and it's a very useful plant. In fact, we used to rely on it for making rope and paper. In fact, Britain wouldn't have ruled the waves without the hemp plant, because our navy depended entirely upon it for all the rigging and all the and the sails and everything like that. People are beginning to think of it as a potential construction material. I should say, actually, that we have a feature in the current issue of the magazine, the February issue, which was out earlier this week, about cannabis and about one particular company that is hoping to exploit it and promote cannabis as a resource. Have you read that article yet, Phil?
I did, but what I'm intrigued about, I mean, I picked up my copy of the magazine for my local WH Smith's. I was drawn by this. I think you had it on the word cannabis on the front cover, and I went, what's David up to here? And it struck me as, I couldn't decide whether this was new, modern and brilliant, or some sort of hippy-dippy going back to Wattle and Daub, West Country, return to basics.
I mean, just because I live in Devon doesn't mean I'm a hippie.
But is the hemp that this company you've written about, that they're promoting as a building product, is it the same thing that was made to build Henry VIII? Navy, or his ships and rigging, or is there something different about it?
It is different. I mean, the material is the same thing. But let me tell you a little bit about it. The company we're talking about here is a very new company. It's called Unite Hemp, or rather the Unite Capital Group. Sounds like a big organisation. It's got umpteen divisions. But in fact, it's only been going a couple of years. It grew out of a company called Waste Recovery Solutions, which sounds a lot more prosaic than Unite Hemp. And in fact, Waste Recovery Solutions was exactly what it sounds like. It's a waste processing organisation based up in the Midlands.
Sounds like somewhere. A mob front to me.
Sounds like a mob front. I'm absolutely certain that it's not. It's nothing like that. But it's a company which processed demolition waste, basically. And a couple of the guys involved in this... in fact, Waste Recovery Solutions itself was only launched in 2014, so it's evolved extremely quickly. These are early days, so we'll have to watch this firm and see what they actually get up to. But they sort of segued very quickly from waste recovery and demolition waste processing to... growing weed. Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what they do. They saw the potential for this, and last year they grew, I think it was 240 acres of hemp in Leicestershire somewhere. This year, they're growing 5,000 acres of hemp, and they say that they want to cultivate up to 40,000 acres of hemp by 2022. So we're talking
about
massive.
What's its application? Is it just sort of insulation material and padding and filling, or are they going to spin it into ropes?
Yeah, well, you can always spin it into rope because, of course, it's absolutely brilliant for that. That's what it was always used for in times gone by. And in fact, you can still buy hemp rope. It's still made. But no,
we're not making bridges out of them anymore.
We're not making bridges out of it anymore. No, we're not. We use steel. We use steel for that, yeah. But I should point out at this stage that when we're talking about hemp, the plant looks just like the cannabis plant that we see on logos and the sort of thing which we associate with drugs. But actually, just like any other crop, there are various different varieties of cannabis sativa, lots of different strains, and only a relatively small number of them contain significant quantities of the psychoactive drug, which is tetrahydrocannabinol, I think it's something like that. THC for short, anyway. And that's the thing that gets you high. But most crops don't have appreciable quantities of THC in them. They're grown for the fibre, principally, and also the woody part of the stem, which is called shiv, not a term I'd ever come across before, but it's a sort of a woody thing. Shiv, I assume, is very good in compression, and the fibre which envelops it is very good in tension. So the stem of a hemp plant is very strong. Apparently it is very difficult to break, in fact. But the way it's used in construction, or could be used in construction, well, it varies. As you say, the fibre itself can be processed and used to create thermal insulation, and it's very good at that. It's got a very high thermal properties. It's also rot resistant. I believe it's even resistant to insect attack and stuff like this. Animals don't like eating it. I assume that you need to treat it to make it fire safe, but it's very good, apparently, very efficient at insulating.
What's it an alternative for? Can it be an alternative for plastics or bad things? Is it an environmentally friendly version of something that we shouldn't be using?
Plastics, funnily enough, is one of these things that obviously we're very much aware of the harm done to the environment by plastics. You can actually synthesize, I don't know how they do it, this isn't explained in the article, but they can synthesize a polymer from the hemp plant and make a form of biodegradable plastic, which again can be used in construction. It can be used obviously to mold components. If it's biodegradable, I assume it's not for external use. The fiber can be processed to create a sort of synthetic wood, which I believe is called hemp oak. And you can actually get sort of hemp lumber. I don't think it's produced in very large quantities. And the shiv, this woody material which comes from the stem, and this has been happening for quite a long time now. It can be combined with hydraulic lime and packed into formwork to create something called hempcrete. And in fact, I wrote about two houses built in Suffolk. This was nearly 20 years ago, I think. The first hempcrete houses built in Suffolk. And I haven't gone back there to find out how well they've performed, but the BRE was studying them and did seem to think that they were performing very well. They were very warm. One interesting thing was that they created a very pleasant environment inside the house because they have certain hempcrete has certain acoustic properties. It absorbs sound and it's not echoey. It's nice and mellow, as you might expect. But anyway, so yeah, this company, Unite Hemp, has set up several divisions. I'll just let you know what they are. Unite Hemp specialises in growing and building the entire UK industrial hemp supply chain. You know, they've got their work.
They're in the medical world as well, are they? They are. Been reading a lot lately about the medical cannabis.
Yes, well, that's right, yes, because there is another drug, not a psychoactive drug in cannabis, called CBD, which is supposed to be very good for treating things like anxiety. And it's been in the news a lot, as you might have noticed, that it can help with various different things. Epilepsy, I think it can help with. And in fact, it's freely available in various different products on the market as a food supplement and as an alternative medicine, that kind of thing. So they've got Unite Health, which is an online retailer of hemp-based food supplements. Unite Medical, which they say was created in response to the changes in legislation and scheduling. Which, in fact, I should mention that this is all made possible by the fact that the law on the cultivation of hemp was relaxed, I think, in, was it 2013? No, it was longer ago than that. It was quite a long time ago. And you could at last start to grow hemp for industrial purposes. It's still very carefully controlled by the Home Office. You need a Home Office license in order to grow the stuff. You can't just scatter a few seeds in a field or in your back garden and grow your own, because of course people would exploit that and we'd have cannabis farms springing up all over the place. So it is very controlled, but you can grow it now. So Unite Capital Group is, it's got Unite Hemp, Unite Energy, which is based in
how much are they
Wales.
Paying you, David?
Pardon?
How much are they paying you? You get a tenner every time you mention the company name.
They're not paying me anything, unfortunately. Yeah, they've got other things. They've got a finance division as well, set up by some regulated financial sort of chappy.
Have they actually had any sales into the construction industry? I mean, you mentioned the Hempcrete trial house in Suffolk, but are there any other? Can you buy their products down at Juicens?
I don't think so. No, they're still in the development phase, and they're working. They're basically, the company is in the business of growing it and promoting it. And in fact, a lot of their divisions, the health, medical, investment thing, they're there ready and waiting, but they haven't really, people haven't beaten a path to their door just yet.
So they're the farmers and they're looking for building materials companies to get
Absolutely.
Rid of Fergo and start buying
And of course, not just
crop.
Building materials, but other industries as well. So, I mean, the plastics, for example, probably be more useful in that kind of thing rather than in construction. But yeah, they're very ambitious, but it is very early days. And, you know, time will tell whether or not this takes off. I think I have to say, I do applaud it in many ways, because it is. It's got a lot going for it, hemp. It's an incredibly easy plant to grow. It grows on very poor soil. It, in fact, one of the, they say, and I haven't had this verified, but apparently it's quite good for remediating contaminated soils, because the plant actually absorbs contaminants. I don't know exactly which contaminants, but I think heavy metals and that kind of thing can actually be sort of leached out of the ground by this plant as it grows. It grows very quickly. It absorbs an awful lot of carbon from the atmosphere as it does so. And of course, if you use that material in buildings or any other product and don't release it back into the atmosphere, then it has a net beneficial effect on, you know, carbon footprint and stuff like that. So it's got that going for it as well. But and I can't honestly see, I mean, hempcrete isn't going to replace brick and block overnight, and it certainly won't be used for building bridges or anything like that. Hemp oak isn't going to replace sort of softwood sawn lumber anytime soon. And although I think the hemp fibre insulation has been used quite a lot, it's been around for a long time, hemp fibre insulation. It's not that new. And it's a sort of thing which is quite popular in sort of self-built projects, rather, because it is a environmentally friendly product and it's pretty well proven as well, so its performance is known. But I don't think that's going to replace rockwool anytime soon. I think we're still going to be using our mineral-based and sort of carbon-based products as well.
Do you think there are any other historic medieval materials that we're overlooking in the 21st century that we should be going back to?
Well, mud, maybe. I live in a part of the world, as you may know, where traditionally...
Muddy here too.
That's true, it is. But yeah, well, you do clever things with your mud down there in Kent. You bake it into bricks. But down in the West Country, they would just basically mix it with straw and build walls out of it. It's called cob. And cob is just mud. It is subsoil, basically, reinforced with straw. And cob has been coming back into fashion within a certain very niche sector of the industry. Again, self-build. There have been companies, I think probably some social housing providers have experimented with COB. It's very warm, it's very environmentally friendly, it's very easy to build with. You don't need an awful lot of skill to build a COB wall. But again, you're not going to see it in the mass market very soon.
Well, I'm a big fan of these rustic traditional materials. I'd like to see more thatched roofed houses around the place. Maybe we could reinvent thatched roofs as a modern method of construction if we can get them. Thatchers working in factories on a production line and lift a thatched roof on in one go.
Well, that's an interesting idea.
I must have a caveat. I have a relative who is a thatcher and thatched the roof of his own barn conversion, did a beautiful job, and he married a lady who made her own candles.
Sounds like a dangerous combination to me.
And so it turned down, the house burnt down.
Oh dear. So are they living in a Barrett home now?
I think they started again.
Well, this article about cannabis and its potential uses in the construction industry is in the latest edition of the Construction Index magazine, the February issue, which is out in news agents now, selected news agents throughout the country. The magazine is now widely available in news agents. It's in the shops on the 16th of every month. So you can, if you aren't a subscriber, you can just walk into your WH Smith or whatever it happens to be and buy your own copy. We've got many different and various articles in this issue. We've got a big feature about the Tideway project. We've got a site report on that, which is very interesting from a technical point of view.
That's the super sewer, isn't it?
This is the super sewer. It's nice reading this, actually, because it's like the old days of Crossrail before it all went bad. and you're marvelling at the ingenuity and skill of these civil engineers tunnelling away underneath London. It really is. It's a fascinating read. We've also got quite an interesting scaffolding story about a company that scaffolded the world's tallest three-cornered obelisk, which happens to be in Somerset. It's the Wellington Monument, just off junction 27 of the M5. In fact, you'll see it from the motorway. It's completely shrouded in scaffolding at the moment, and it's quite a fascinating job. Quite an interesting project from the point of view of old materials as well. There's a lot of lime in there, Phil. And what else have we got in here? So much. We've got a sector focus looking at the UK's earth movers as well.
And there's a supplement with it as well this week, this month or rather.
There is a supplement. It's not produced by us.
National Access and Scaffolding Confederation's annual.
That's right, yes.
It's free with the magazine this month.
Which is free with the magazine, yeah. So you can get that as well. Yeah, so added value.
Moving on?
Yeah, moving on. Let's move on to the second topic. Completely different topic, this one, but again, a perennial concern, immigration. Immigration and the skills shortage. And there was an announcement today, I believe, by the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, about changes in the immigration rules. Can you just give us a quick précis of what that is and what she said?
Essentially, it's what we knew was coming, but we're getting a bit more detail on the back of it, which was moving to a points-based system, often called an Australian-style points-based system, where if you tick the right boxes in terms of economics and economic potential, as in skills and education and so forth, you're welcome. If you're low-skilled, you're not welcome, which is a big change from the sort of post-war years when we had labour shortages and we open the doors with welcome arms for the Windrush generation and other parts of the world to run the railways and work in the hospitals and so on. The new immigration rules, which is all made possible by the UK leaving the European Union, means an end to the freedom of movement of people from the rest of the European Union, or the European Union as it now will be in a year's time. And they will have to, whether you're from France or Spain, or I'm not sure what the exceptions are for the Republic of Ireland. I think there's a different regime for that. But for the rest of the European Union, you will have to, basically, if you want to come and work in the UK, you'll have to get a full-time job with a salary of 25,600.
They've relaxed that, haven't they? Because it was
going to be 30,000.
Yeah.
And an awful lot of these new immigration rules, you will see it reported, I mean, depending which paper, you'll either see it reported as, racist, right-wing, xenophobic, terrible thing, or you'll see it reported as, hurrah, government getting a grip on immigration.
Yeah.
But in either of those terms, there is a populist undertone to it. But despite that, or as well as that, depending on where you're coming from, government have made it a lot more business-friendly, a lot less populist than the first soundings that they were making. I mean, it was going to be keeping almost everyone out unless they were, millionaires and or whatever.
Oh, we like to bring millionaires in, don't we? Yeah, they're welcome.
Well, exactly. We welcome them, but we don't tax them very well.
No, that's right.
But it seems to me that government is a science of compromise between the people that give you power and the people that give you money.
Yeah.
Which in the current government context, it's the voters and business. Now, while there is perceived to be voter demand for tighter immigration, most business vested interests actually like immigration. They like, particularly in the construction industry, to bring it back down to our subject here, there's something like, roughly speaking, 1 in 10 of the UK construction workforce was born not in the UK. In fact, I've seen one figure, it's as high as 14%. It depends whereabouts in the country you are. It's much higher in London than
provinces. I heard a figure. I'm sure that somebody said sometime last year that 80% of people working in the house building industry in Greater London area were not UK citizens. I mean, I think 80% sounds implausible, but that was a figure I read. I know it's a lot. It's highly dependent on immigrant labour, in the London area.
The figure I've seen is 50%.
That's still a lot.
It is still a lot. And this 30 grand a year threshold would have been a kicker. Now, the immediate response from the construction industry is that having the taps turned off to the free access to, and let's face it, we're talking specifically Eastern European labour here, having free access to these people is a bad thing. We've already got a skills shortage. And it's only going to get worse. But actually, if you're talking about London, £25,600 annual salary is, I did a quick totting up, if you're working a 40-hour week, it's only around £12.50 an hour, which is a bit above the London living wage of £10.55 an hour. But it's not a huge salary for a full-time construction worker who you hope to buy their loyalty and keep them on board if you're going to be employing them in London. So that might not be the deal breaker that people are thinking it is. And if it does push up wages in the construction industry, I think that's going to be a good thing.
Yeah.
As long as the tender prices will go up on the back of it, get a bit of inflation if the customers have to pay for it in the end run. A little bit of wage increase in the construction industry, I think would be problematic if that's what happens.
This salary threshold, a little bit, I'm not quite sure what it serves to do. I mean, obviously you don't want people coming in here and signing on the dole. You want people to come in here, come into the UK and contribute, obviously. But if we're talking about people earning a certain amount of money or perhaps possessing certain skills, I just wonder if we're taking the wrong view, that instead of trying to attract in skills from outside, we should be developing our own. And I say this because, for example, in the health sector, it also quite dependent on people from outside the UK. If you go into a hospital, the nursing staff, the doctors, a significant proportion of them are very often from outside the UK. A lot of people, again, from Eastern Europe.
But in the health sector, my experience visiting hospitals is that it's not such, the migrant labour in the health sector is not particularly Eastern Europe. I mean, they're South Asian, they're from everywhere. And there are restrictions on non-EU nationals at the moment. So I'm not quite sure how much harder it will be under the new system for the health sector than it is today.
How much harder in what respect, you mean?
Well, at the moment, the health sector is recruiting perfectly satisfactorily, it seems to me.
Oh, I see what you mean, yes. Well, I don't know.
Is that tap going to be turned off?
Presumably. If you pitch up at Dover and say, I'm a qualified heart surgeon, the NHS will snap you up because, you know, they will want somebody with those skills, and they won't want the cost of having to train them up themselves. I mean, if you're going to become a doctor in the UK, and I have a vested interest here, I have to say, because my son has just got a place at medical school, and he's had to jump through numerous hoops in order to get there. It's not easy. I mean, they do everything they can to put you off. I just think if you can import your skills ready trained from Bulgaria or Mumbai or somewhere like that, then why go to all that bother when, you know, somebody can just walk in from somewhere else?
But I think the problem the construction industry has, it's such a fragmented industry where most of the companies are very small outfits that don't have the HR departments to manage training and so on. And therefore, historically, the construction industry, even with the existence of the Construction Industry Training Board, has not been great at delivering training, organised, structured training programmes in a comprehensive basis. Now, of course, there are masses of exceptions and masses of great apprenticeship schemes out there. But on industry-wide level, and we're talking about needing 40,000 new recruits every year, we're struggling to get the 40,000 new recruits every year from UK schools and colleges. And part of that goes back to the wages that the industry offers. Now, if a tightening of the immigration system means that wages go up, and then the construction industry becomes more attractive to a UK school leaver, college leaver, all good, I reckon.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if that's the way it works. I'm not sure what the Priti Patel sees in those terms, because I think the phrase she said was that she wanted to attract the brightest and the best from around the world, and which is fine, I suppose. But we want some of the brightest and the best from around the world to be actually grown here.
Well, her actual quote was, and she piled on the cliches, we're ending free movement, taking back control of our borders and delivering on the people's priorities. I don't know what the people's priorities are. I think the government's priorities. Bring overall migration numbers
down.
I'm
sure she'll tell us.
As you say, we'll attract the brightest and the best and unleash this country's full potential. I mean, it's really laboured, frankly, the political language of it all. But my fear is, although I don't have a problem with this 25,600 salary threshold coming in, being reduced from 30,000, I think that's positive. But my fear is, in the short term, we're not going to, you know, the construction industry is not going to get its act together and sort out a domestic training programme, revolutionised domestic programme training in the next 2 years, 5 years, or probably even 10 years. So there will be, I think, difficulties for the first few years after this new regime comes in on the 1st of January 2021. Yes. There's going to be trouble.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're probably right. Okay, shall we move on to smart cities?
Yeah, this was an interesting press release that I don't know whether it originated from Amy or Sheffield City Council, but the two organisations are working together. Amy is the highway maintenance contractor in Sheffield City Council. It's got a contract that runs till 2027 or something like that. It's a big 10-year deal. And previously they've had a lot of controversy, Amy and Sheffield, for chopping down trees that looked like they might be a bit of an expensive maintenance issue because they were making paving slabs pop up. So they said, we'll just take them out then. And that that became quite a lightning conductor for the local papers. And Amy didn't come out of that smelling of roses particularly, but this one, they're looking quite good. What's happened is they're sewing smart sensors all over the city, initially in litter bins, 2,000 litter bin sensors around the city of Sheffield, and in the grit bins, those bins of for road gritting material, and also sensors in gullies. And the idea being that with these sensors, they can tell when the bins need emptying, they can tell when the grit bins need filling, and they tell when the gullies are getting flooded or blocked. And it all sounds very smart. Now, they're not the first to be doing this. Hull, back end of last year, Hull City Council is working with the technology company behind all of this. It's a company called Connexin, who are working with Amy. And Connexin is also working with Hull City Council And they call it a smart city operating system. I don't have the details of what Hull are doing, but there's a similar sort of thing about to make sure they know what, you know, that the bins are being emptied properly or on time or not getting over full. And it's quite prosaic at this level when you're talking about bin monitors. But the idea is that they will gather masses of data. And I don't know if you saw the BBC Panorama documentary on Amazon this week. And Amazon,
I must watch that.
We think we think of Amazon as an online retailer. Well, that's a bit like thinking of DFS as a furniture shop. Of course, DFS is not a furniture shop; it's a finance house, and Amazon is not a retailer. It's a data collection agency,
data company.
Yeah. And that's where the money is, and the real business behind it all. So the idea is that Sheffield and Amy will be able to collect up all this data and deliver new and better ways to deliver public services. I'm not quite sure where it's going to extend to after the litter bins and gritters and gullies, but the idea of a digitally connected highway maintenance services.
Well, there was some on your. You wrote a story about this morning, which is up on the website right now, and there's a link to a video at the bottom of it, which is various talking heads from Sheffield City Council and from Connexin and
the other tech companies involved.
Cisco, yeah, the other tech companies. Quite a lot of people talking about this. And yes, I think on balance it's a good thing because, you know, it's great if you don't have to drive around actually looking in the bins to see if they need emptying. If the bins will tell you, come and empty me, you can save a lot of time and trouble and a lot of vehicle movements.
But they've been emptying these bins since the Victorian times. You would have thought they'd have a handle on how often they need emptying by now.
I know. I just think perhaps it's been rather overhyped. Because I mean, they are just. I think it's litter bins, gritting bins, roadside gullies, and trees. Because they're also using these sensors to tell them when they should go and water their trees in the summer. Which is, I didn't think that was an issue, but obviously it is. I thought it rained quite a lot in Sheffield, but anyway. So those are the four metrics basically, and they seem to be they're really talking it up, that they're mining this data and they're going to do massive things to it. And there were a complete solution that presents the city's assets in a single aggregated view was a phrase used by the Connexin sales director. And I thought that was a pretty hard sell, because it will tell you anything you need to know about your bins and about your gullies and your trees. But I mean, the city's assets.
But I don't know whether this is how the tech people have sold it to the council, or whether this is how the councillors are selling it to the public. I think a lot of the public are pretty sceptical and sceptical of having sensors in their bins. They're going to think there's going to be in their personal domestic bin, and you know, someone's going to police that they're not throwing away too many wine bottles or whatever. But the way it seems to be being sold in that short film that you're talking about, is that this is a sustainability initiative. This is going to help meet net zero carbon targets, and it's all about reducing vehicle movements. And it's not about, I mean, that may be a side effect, but clearly the whole point for doing this is to, if it has any benefit at all, is to make the delivery of public services more efficient, which means cheaper. Or you get more for the same amount of money, or you get the same for less amount of money.
Yeah.
Now, that's a good thing and a great reason for doing it.
It is.
But you don't hear that as an argument anymore in the delivery of public services or in politics or in government. No one ever says, we're doing this because it's cheaper. We're doing this because it'll save you money. We're doing this because it's a more efficient way of doing it. They say, we're doing this because it's sustainable. Now, that may be great, but what is wrong, for heaven's sake, with the traditional reason for doing things? Because it's better use of money. Money is a perfectly good resource to talk about, and it needs to be talked about. But it's
not mentioned anyway. I think The trouble is that that's a bit dull. It's a bit too obvious for most people. I mean, saving money isn't constantly in the news at the moment. I mean, it's there underlying so many other things, but it's not the story. The story is global warming, pollution, climate change, and all the rest of that. So you have to couch it in those terms in order to make people sit up and take notice. Maybe that's why they're doing it, but I can't see that they can really sell this as a massive benefit to the environment, either the local environment of Sheffield or the global environment.
Well, I imagine if they've got the sensors on the litter bins, there's no point. I mean, unless that litter bin is got a week old Big Mac in the bottom of it and it's going to attract rats or whatever. But if the litter bin is essentially clean waste, for want of a better word, there's no point emptying it every day when it's only a quarter full. Wait till it's a day, full for a day, and it's the same old thing of changing light bulbs, isn't it? It's actually more efficient to change a light bulb before it blows. You do them all at once if you're in a shopping centre or something. You change them once a year, or probably these days once every 5 years, whatever it is, whether they need it or not, because of the cost of the operation is so great. And that's probably the same with the litter bins as well. So I don't know. Is it better to empty a half full litter bin because you're going past it, or is it better to wait until it's full? I guess this is the kind of data they'll be collecting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one phrase, I can't remember who actually said it in this video, they said it'll digitally connect the highway's maintenance services and keep AMI operatives informed about the condition of street assets. And they'll know about the condition of the bins. But I thought, what about the potholes? What about those broken paving slabs that people are tripping up? I mean, will it tell? What about broken traffic lights?
Well, I suspect, I think broken traffic lights is a different thing. I think they probably do know that, because I think they tend to be all the central communication control, which is why many traffic lights these days, if there's no one around and you drive up to a red light, it changes green because there's a sensor.
Yes,
and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I think when we're talking about really, really smart is sensors in the road surface, a long continual line like your Skeletics track, which not only charges your electric car as you're driving along, but will know that the surface of the road has broken up above the wire, the sensor, or the sensor under the road surface. And I think when we start getting to that level of smart, then we've got something super useful. Mm. But I still come back.
And I think we ought to remember that we had a conversation recently about another smart infrastructure, and that was the smart motorways, which, of course, it's a concept with egg on its face now, isn't it? Because we had that expose by the BBC, which showed that smart motorways were not only not that smart, but they're actually potentially very dangerous. Smart is another buzz phrase, another buzzword, isn't it? Smart this, smart that. It's a sort of thing which grabs people's attention and they think, oh, that's clever. They talk about the Internet of Things. In fact, this was a phrase used in this story, was that they're using the Internet of Things to connect the Sheffield City's street assets. And when you couch it in terms like that, it sounds terribly clever. And I'm sure it's pretty clever technology, but it's doing a very simple job, telling you when your bins need emptying.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to myself, Phil Bishop, and David Taylor for another issue of Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast. We'll be back again the same time next week. If you've enjoyed listening to us, you might want to think about subscribing from Apple Podcasts or whatever your preferred podcast supply source is. And you may even wish to leave us a review. That'd be nice. Tell us your thoughts, give us some feedback, or you can email us at podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news every day, visit theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can find the latest issue of the Construction Index magazine in WH Smith and independent newsagents UK-wide. Use our store locator to find your nearest stockist today at theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine.